You're listening to a UC San Diego podcast.
Years ago, probably before most of you were on campus, there was a very unfortunate incident. Very unfortunate is not a strong enough word. It was a very bad incident with students mocking a particular racial ethnic group on campus. And that's what prompted, so before each college at UCSD had its own diversity rules, and you know, each college wanted to promote the understanding of diversity, but they each did it in a bit of a different way. After that incident a couple years ago, the university decided to look again at that policy and decided to have one standardized policy that would apply to students in every college. And as part of that, they reviewed all of the courses that had previously been listed as meeting different, you know, different colleges' requirements and decided whether or not they counted. This one was decided to not count because the kind of diversity that we often focus on is not the same kind of issue there. We were very disappointed to hear that because we believe that it's very important to understand diversity in many senses, cultural, ethnic, linguistic, sensory, biological. We are revamping the course. A lot of the material that we've put in this year is intended to convince the university that this course does deserve its place as meeting university requirements, but I doubt that it will be possible to retroactively activate that. Yeah?
Well, I think if you came in before like fall 2011, they allow you to take this as an academic.
Okay, I don't know about that. I have been sort of out of touch with the process, but. Okay. Great. So Jason is saying that it may be the case that some students who are sort of grandfathered in under the old system may still be able to have this course count. I don't know. If you are concerned about that and you want me to check on it, please send me an email and tell me what college you are and what year you are, and I can check with the university people and see if it's going to work for you. I hope it does. I mean, I really believe that this course does do a lot to educate us all about diversity in many different senses of the word. So I would love to go to battle for you to make that work. Any other questions? All right. Let's frequency BB is probably going to yell at me for not having that yet. It says no base. Just a second. There we go. Starts. Okay. That's better. All right. So as you know from the announcement I sent yesterday, your midterms aren't graded yet. Apologize for that. We'll get them. They'll be ready by next Tuesday. And we'll post them as soon as I'm ready to post them. It'll be before class. And after your grades are posted, if you want to come review your exam, you're free to do so. And in fact, you're highly encouraged to do so. Because there's a lot of, you can learn a lot from not just in terms of the content of the things that you missed. You're probably narrowed down to like, oh, it's either this one or this one, and maybe you just picked the wrong one. But you also can learn a lot about the types of mistakes that you might tend to make. Sometimes people make mistakes where they just bubble in the wrong, number. Sometimes people make mistakes where they don't read the question carefully enough. So going back and looking at your exams is a really good way to learn about your own tendencies as a student. It can be very helpful. So you can come to any of our office hours to do that. I would like a little feedback from you. Let me just set this to anonymous. There we go. Oh, you couldn't see that I just did that. There, it's anonymous. That's what that little thing means. So I just would like to know what you thought. Close. Don't worry. All right, should be open now. So was it way harder than you thought? A little harder? Question? We're going to hang on to them, but you can come to office hours, look at them, take notes on what you missed, and then give them back. Yeah, and you'll be able to see both your response sheet as well as the actual paper that you might have made notes to scratch marks on. Absolutely. Well, so it's your responsibility to come see us to look over your exams. And you can do that anytime between when we have the grades posted and the final. Any other questions? Let's give this, I don't know how many people. Actually, yeah, I have no way to know how many people have responded. So. All right. We'll wait out the minute. This is partially curiosity for me. Yeah, okay. Okay, well, I think that's about right. Cool, thank you for sharing your thoughts. Now the extra credit stuff may be a little more relevant in people's minds, so I just wanted to give you a reminder that if you want to write a paper connecting some concept that we've talked about in class to things that you have observed or experienced outside of class, I need to know what your request for the topic is going to be by Tuesday on, it's 2 weeks, I guess, November 20th, by the end of class. You need to send me something in writing would be easiest, or if you want to come to office hours, we can talk about it there as well. I can't have a rush of students coming up at the end of class and saying things verbally, so just send me a note, and then I will reply to you before Thanksgiving to tell you, you know, thumbs up, thumbs down, or how you need to adjust that topic or focus a little bit to make it a good paper topic. You can also do experimental participation. This is through the SONA system with UCSD. That is open until Wednesday of week 10, which is December 5th. And then it's up. So when you go participate in those kinds of experiments, your account will accrue credits. But that system doesn't know what class you want to apply those credits to until you tell it. So that's something that you need to go do and say, I want my 2 credits of experiment, you know, to apply to Link 7 and not to Psych 1 or who knows what. Okay. Also, I made a few changes. I just moved some readings around on the syllabus. I posted that last night. Hopefully, you've been able to download that. If anybody has trouble, let me know. Nothing, no major changes to the grading scheme or anything like that. And there will be tutorials again next week. Might seem like we're throwing a lot at you all at once, but after I give the lecture today, you might want the tutorial. Because today is going to be another day where we talk about linguistic puzzles, and there's going to be a lot of new stuff, new structures, new patterns, and going to the tutorials is going to be a chance for you to work through all that, kind of get the hands-on sense of how the system is put together and how to manipulate it to understand how all the different parts work. Questions on any of this? All right. So today we're going to, today kind of marks a shift in the kinds of linguistic structures that we're looking at. So far, we've been really focused on very small bits of linguistic structure. So somebody tell me, what's the smallest bit of linguistic structure that you can think of? A phoneme? Is there anything smaller than a phoneme? Can we describe a phoneme as being made up of parts? I'm getting a nod. Can I call you out, Katie? Parameters, or another word? Features, right? These subphonemic features, right? So in speech, these are things like voice and place and manner and nasality. In sign, these are things like hand shape, orientation, movement, location. Right? Those are all things that are very small basic units, and we can't break those down into anything smaller. So those features combine to form phonemes, which combine to form morphemes, good. Which combine to form, all right. And so here, words is what we call the lexical level. I'm going to pause here for a second. That progression should not be mysterious. That's definitely something that you should know. So I was kind of expecting to hear a chorus of people say, features combine to form phonemes and then morphemes. Right? That should be really familiar by now. So if it's not, get familiar with it. So this is the lexical level. Lexical is just another word for word. So everything down here is called, there we go. All right. That's all we've focused on so far. So now we're going to make the big jump to talk about what words combine to form, which are phrases. And then phrases combine to form sentences. And then sentences combine to form this thing called discourse. And so this is what we're going to focus the rest of the class on. As these levels of linguistic structure. Anybody know what the term for structure up here is? Syntactic structure. That's right, syntax. Often people use the word grammar to talk about the stuff that's above the line. But as linguists, the term grammar for us actually has a much broader meaning. The grammar kind of refers to the entire system. So we can talk about a phonological grammar or a morphological grammar. And so for the purposes of this class, when we say syntactic structure, we're going to refer to the stuff that's above the lexical level, stuff that involves combinations of more than one word or sign, right? All right. So today what we're going to tackle in lecture, and we're probably not going to get through all of this today, and that's fine. So slow me down if you want me to put the brakes on a little bit. We're going to talk about... That's my screen. We're going to talk about the functions of the face in ASL, both in terms of linguistic and emotional function. We're going to talk about a couple new syntactic structures that are pretty common in ASL. And we're going to try to get in this topic called classifiers, which we may not get there today, but that's all right. So let's start with this. Does anybody recognize this woman? What?
Yes.
Who is she?
She was a signer for the mayor of New York during the hurricane.
That's right. That's right. So this is the professional ASL interpreter for Mayor Bloomberg in New York City. So how many people? Just we have one student who recognized her? Two, three, four, five. Okay. All right. So she got a lot of media coverage, a lot of media attention, often, you know, because she's doing interesting things with her face. So I want to show you, for those of you who haven't seen her, this is what the nation saw last week, or I guess a week and a half ago. Sorry, there's going to be some ads that we have to wait through. All right, she's really good. I don't know if you can tell, especially the non-signers in the room. She's really good. She's doing her job, and she's doing it very well. A lot of people found this highly amusing. So this is a clip from Chelsea Lately. Sorry. Oh, just you wait.
Sure, you could be an interpreter too. I mean, you wouldn't be a very good one because you're a little bit. You might be able to have a bigger just because nobody can understand anything you're saying.
Okay. We're not done. We're not done. So, SNL thought this was really funny too. You guys didn't see this? All right.
Thank you.
All right. We're not done. This is New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. All right. We're almost done. Just one more, actually. That Lydia Callis has her own Tumblr now. Not Lydia Callis. Lydia Callis Face. Nobody bothered to check how her name was spelled, apparently. So I'm just going to scroll through her Tumblr real fast, just to drive home the point that this is happening. Okay, so we got that. We got yeah. Okay. It goes on, it goes on. All right, so yeah, it's this, great. All right, so why all the fuss? And actually, I want to get your reactions or what your prediction about how have deaf people, how has the American deaf community reacted to this coverage of Lydia Callis and her signing and her facial expressions? Let's say 10 more seconds. Okay. All right, so what do we got? Yeah, okay. Let me pull this down a little bit. So by far the most common reaction here is that deaf people are offended because hearing people are mocking ASL. And then there's a range of other responses. So I have actually, in my observations and interactions with my deaf friends and reading deaf blogs and stuff, I have seen the whole range of reactions. Less, not so much A, like some, but B through E are actually all represented across the deaf blogs and the friends and the other deaf community statements that I've had. I think your intuition, though, is a good one, and it's one that I'm glad you have. I will say that there, some of these portrayals were considered more offensive than others. So I want to hear from somebody who doesn't know ASL. So those of you who do sign, don't answer this question. But somebody who doesn't know ASL, raise your hand and tell me something that you observed, or tell me which interpreter or interpreters in the mock, the Chelsea Lately and the SNL skits, which of them were closer to ASL? Yeah, Maya? Or just tell me what you were observing.
Well, I thought that Chelsea Handler was more offensive than SNL.
Why?
I think if something's on SNL, even if it is slightly offensive, it's more of like, it's an honor because it has a lot of history behind SNL and they're very political and, I don't know, I think they mean less harm than someone else.
Yeah. Part of that is just the nature of the show, right? SNL is a humor show and Chelsea Lately makes humor by insulting people. Yeah. Other thoughts? Yeah.
Watching the SNL, I thought before this.
Okay.
But it seemed like it was mocking more the difference between New York and New Jersey rather than ASL signers. Like, of course, there's like the funny, like the fireman police.
Right.
But that's just a manner of doing an over-exaggerated gesture, whether you're hearing or signing. It's like little kid funny. But the point of the humor in that sketch was the like pulled togetherness of the New Yorkers versus the like New Jersey stereotype.
Yep.
So it didn't really seem to be mocking ASL as much. It's just falling back on the old state rivalry.
Yep.
And it seemed like a vehicle to do that.
Yep, I think that is bang on. I think that's exactly what's going on. And so if I had broken this, if I had pulled my deaf friends and asked them to rate each of those clips separately, they were generally offended by Chelsea Lately and thought SNL was funny. And it's precisely for that reason, because SNL was mocking New York and New Jersey, whereas Chelsea Lately was like, signers are weird and funny and strange. And, the clip actually gets much worse from then on, such that I did not feel comfortable showing that in class. And actually, Jon Stewart did one too that was also really bad. So good, okay. This is an important point, both culturally speaking, just to understand how majority and minority culture interactions can happen and what's the role of humor in that. I think you've gotten that. But it happens to be a very timely and helpful segue into talking about what is the face doing in ASL? Why does Lydia Callas, as a signer, have such, expression or has such an expressive face? And it's because the face is actually doing a lot of things for us in sign. One of the things that the face does in ASL is the same as the face always does for humans, right? It conveys emotions. And so you can use your face to convey your own emotional state. You can also use your face to convey somebody else's emotional state if you are, reporting their speech or taking on their role. And these are things that are actually, they're biologically innate, right? We don't actually, we smile, our expressions of happiness and fear and anger are universal across cultures. They show up in children who have not been socialized in a typical family experience. These are things that, like it or not, your face is going to do because your body makes it. So we can look at how this influences sign language by looking at page 60 or 78 and 79 of your reader. There's a nice spread with a single pronoun in the sign language of the Netherlands. And these pages show how one sign can take on a huge range of different meanings depending on the facial expression with which it's produced. But here, the difference among the meanings is all emotional. So we have the pronoun me, neutral. We have me, right? We have me, or me. I think the illustrations here are pretty clear that you can get all of that communicative meaning. All of the differences between these different utterances are, is it a question? Is it a statement? Is it an insult? Is it a surprise? All those are kinds of information can be carried by the facial expression, even on just this single sign. And this would happen in English too. But how would we express, if I were only going to say the word me, how would I express these different emotional states? Yeah? Tone? Yep, so tone of voice. Can you give me an example?
Like, you say me, or your voice would go up, or you're
angry at me, the emphasis that you put on what voice. That's right, yeah. Yeah, so... we do this, tone was the word that was suggested. The term we use for this is a related word. It's called intonation. It has that root tone in it. And so in spoken languages like English, often intonation can carry the same information that's being conveyed by facial expression in ASL. It's also likely, though, that our facial expressions in English would be very similar to these ones. If we're saying, I don't say, me! Angrily, right? That's weird. I would say, me! So those go hand in hand nicely. And I think that's why people are so captivated by facial expressions in Lydia Callas, because it looks like she's going through these intense emotional experiences, one right after the other, and these strange sequences, and it's really disorienting for somebody who's used to seeing the face only do this. And in spoken language, that's really all the face does. It's a lot of work, but it's pretty restricted to this emotional domain. However, in ASL, we see that the face conveys a ton of linguistic information as well. We're going to step through each of these over the course of the lecture, depending on how far we get. So polar questions, content questions, adverbs, topicalization, subject copy, and negation all involve linguistic functions of the head and face. You don't need to worry about copying that down because we're about to step through each of them in turn. First one is polar questions. What's a polar question? It's not this. That's right. It's a yes or no question. It's called polar because the same way that a battery or a magnet has two poles, positive and negative, a polar question can have only a yes or no answer. And so sometimes we might call these yes-no questions, but the broader linguistic term for these is polar questions. So how do they work in English? We have a declarative sentence. That's one that's not a question. The student knows ASL. So how am I going to make that into a polar question? Great. How did you do that? Yeah, okay, yeah. Say it again. Inverted verb structure. Well, okay, so the verb know looks like it's in the same place here. So what kind of verb structure do you mean? Yeah?
Well, you added does.
I added does. Good. Why did I add does? Why didn't I say, do the student know ASL?
Well, subject verb agreement.
Subject verb agreement. But the subject here is the student, and the verb is know. So where did the... Why is this... does and not do? And what happened to the verb? Why is this one know and not knows? Anybody? Yeah, Jason. Well, the uncertainty comes, it's kind of part of parcel of asking a question. It's sort of weird to ask a question that you don't know the answer to. That you do know the answer to. Yeah? Okay, so when we add the word, when we add this thing called do support, or periphrastic do, if you want to be super technical, the form of the verb to do depends on the form of what the underlying main verb was. So here, this verb was in third person singular, and we know that because English marks that with an S, so the student knows ASL. Whatever inflection was on that root verb gets transferred to the do support verb, and then you're left with the plain, uninflected base form of know. Does that make sense? But I share that partially because, you know, I'm just teaching you how this works, but also to point out that this is a process that is like so unconscious for you, right? You all did that instantly, but it was hard to explain the steps that you went through to make that happen. Right, this is, again, part of your linguistic intuitions. This is part of your internal grammar that you know, but that it's hard to make explicit unless we actually break it down like this. Okay, so this is definitely the basic form that English uses to make polar questions. Is this the only thing that English can do? Does English have another way to take this and make it interrogative? Okay. We have this, we can actually add intonation and say, the student knows ASL. And then that too begs either a yes or a no. Right? So we can do that without changing any of the words. All we do is add this intonation that goes across the entire sentence. It persists throughout the entire sentence, but crucially ends with a rising intonation at the end of the sentence. And these are pretty much the two ways that English can make polar questions. Any questions on that? With that intonational? All right. So, right. These are the two options. We can add do support and adjust verb agreement accordingly. Or we can keep the word the same and add rising intonation. So let's take a look at how ASL does it now. We have a declarative sentence like, the students need to study every day. I haven't looked at your midterms yet. This is not an indictment. The basic declarative form would look something like this. So we have student needs study every day. Student needs study every day. Okay. But if we want to turn that into a polar question, it's going to look something like this. Okay? I'll do that again. So I'll do the declarative and then the interrogative, and you tell me what the difference is. Okay? Yeah. Pointing to the eyebrows. And what did the eyebrows do? They raised them? I did. We're going to focus mainly on the eyebrows for now, but you're right. So I raised the eyebrows, and when did I raise them and for how long? The whole entire time, right? So we write that sentence with notation that looks like this. So the signs you'll notice are the same. Student needs study every day. Student needs study every day. But we have this funny extra stuff on top of it. So there's this thing. These are the little symbols that we're going to use to reflect raised eyebrows. This is just a notation of convenience that works well for us. And then this line here, that shows the scope or the duration of the eyebrow raise. So everything that is underneath that line is produced with raised eyebrows. Right? And this is a notation that we're going to use from now on in the class, so it's good to get used to. Okay? Is there a question? All right, so let's just take a quick look side by side. English does this thing where we change word order, add do support, and adjust verb agreement. Bless you. ASL has this thing where we raise eyebrows across the sentence. Those look pretty different, right? But if we actually think about the second way that English makes questions, we start to see a bit of a similarity here. So in both of these cases, the only mechanism for ASL and then the secondary mechanism for English, both of them keep all of the words the same, and both of them add this thing that attaches across the whole scope of the sentence. In English, it's rising intonation. In ASL, it's raised eyebrows. And we're going to see that parallel kind of hold fairly steady, that a lot of things that English does with intonation show up on the face in ASL. So in particular, we can divide the facial zone in half and note that intonation goes on in the upper half of the face. These raised eyebrows are one example of that. All right? Any questions on yes, no questions? Polar questions? Cool. Yeah?
I remember learning ASL that don't you copy the pronouns as well? Like, you know ASL, you?
We're going to get there.
Okay.
We're going to get there. One step at a time. Okay, so content questions. Anyone want to guess what content questions are? Say it. Sure. Right. Content questions are ones that can't really be answered by yes or no.
What, where, when, why questions?
Right. So both of these points are exactly correct. They require more than a yes-no answer. And in English, they usually start with one of these question words. Who, what, when, where, why, how as well. We often call these WH questions. Again, a sort of more technical term is content questions. So we have our declarative sentence, the student needs to study. Somebody take that and make it into a WH question for me.
When does the student need to study?
Okay, good. So when does the student need to study? Sure. And it would have worked the same thing. You could have said, who does the student need to study? What does? Where does? Etc. How did you do this? Did everyone hear that? That's exactly right. So in order to make a content question in English, all you have to do is make a polar question and then slap a WH word onto the front of it. Right, it has exactly the same steps going on with this do support taking on the inflection. So the third person singular inflection moves from need to this auxiliary verb. I should probably write that word down. It's a good word. So this do is called an auxiliary. Can you see that over there? That was yes? Okay. So the inflection changes from the main verb to the auxiliary verb, and then the WH word tacks on the front of it. That makes sense for English? All right, so now we get to look at how the same process works in ASL. We have a regular old sentence again. So student needs study. Now I'm going to make it, what was the word we had, when? Now I'm going to take that and turn it into the WH form, when does the student need to study? It's going to look like, here's the regular one. And now, OK, what happened? Yes. Ear, OK. So there's a bit of a head tilt. Uh-huh. What else happened? Furrowed the eyebrows. Okay? So again, it was the eyebrows down. How long or when are the eyebrows down? The entire time. That's right. So we have an interrogative like, when does the student need study? But, and so, okay, you have this. This is our notation for furrowed eyebrows. The caret's pointing the other way now. And once again, we see that vertical line being produced over the entire sentence, indicating that the facial expression starts at the beginning and persists through the whole sentence. But ASL also lets you make questions a few other ways. So I can say, I can communicate the same meaning just as grammatically by producing a sentence that looks like this. So student needs study when, where the WH word comes at the end of the sentence. Okay. And ASL feels rather open-minded. I can do it both at the beginning and the end. I can say something like, so the third sentence, when student needs study, when. Okay. This is, so the rules here are furrow your eyebrows over the whole sentence, and then put the WH word at the beginning is fine, at the end is fine, or both is fine. Yeah?
When you use both, is that considered maybe like a stronger form of the question? Like you really need to know the answer, or you're trying to reinforce the point, or is it just the same value?
There's discussion about that. People are trying to pin down exactly that, you know, what is communicated by assigner's choice to double the WH word. Those tend to be really difficult arguments to, difficult questions to answer. Because it's, you know, people are different and speakers are different. It's sort of like trying to ask, you know, what's the difference between somebody saying, I gave a present to my friend versus I gave my friend a present. He's like, oh, they mean awfully the same thing, but maybe there's some differences between when you use one and the other. It's hard to pin down. And so it's a fair question, and if you want to dig into it more, it's an open field for research. All right, so this is, again, eyebrow furrowing. One observation that's cool about this. So turn to page 80 in your reader. You've seen this page before. This is when we talked about the origin of English, and I showed you this tree of Proto-Indo-European and how all of these spoken languages come from this, you know, original ancestor language. One way that we know that, one among many, but one way that we know that is that in all of the languages that are represented on that page, I haven't counted, but there's dozens of them, content question formation in all of those languages works the same way. It looks like English. You put the WH word at the beginning, and that's the only place it can go. Whereas ASL here is doing something radically different from that entire language family. So just in case you weren't convinced yet, that ASL is its own language, that its syntax is not derived from representing how English works. This is another source of evidence to show us that it's its own linguistic thing, it plays by its own rules, and so we have to understand it on its own terms. Anything else on question formation? Yes. You can. But it's certainly not, it's not basic in the same sense that this is. Can you tell that that's like what we would call a marked utterance? It's sort of a departure from the norm. So the student needs, I could ask you, for example, your name is what? And that's okay, but it's not the same as saying, what's your name? Right? What's your name is the more basic process. And that is what is true across all of the languages on page 81. Yeah, 80. The basic process involves the WH word at the beginning, and certainly not doubled. I'm not sure. I don't know if any of these languages permit doubling. I don't think they do. All right, so we saw before intonation is up on the upper face zone, and WH furrowing also involves the upper face zone. We're going to keep coming back to this chart and adding more and more features of the face to it. Next thing to talk about, I know we're sort of just jumping structure to structure, but unless you want to slow me down, I'm just going to keep plowing ahead. Adverbs in English. Adverbs are kind of weird in English, like many things in English. So the students answered effortlessly. What's the adverb in the sentence? Right. And what is the adverb doing? Yes, and then I heard some other folks as well. It describes the verb, yeah. It modifies, in this case, the verb. And it can also, it can go in different places, right? So I can say, the student carelessly bubbled in his answers. I can say, carefully, the instructor explained the answers. And all of those positions are fine. So adverbs in English tend to express the way in which something was done. They usually modify verbs. They can also modify adjectives, but primarily their job is to modify verbs. In English, they are expressed with a separate word, right? So I don't add a morpheme to the verb directly to express manner. Sorry, let me also go back up to this first point. So expressing the way in which something was done, this is called its manner. And that's a, write that down. Aspect is another function that adverbs can serve. And we've already talked about how ASL incorporates aspects into inflecting verbs. Manner is this term for expressing the way in which something is done. Aspect is about time. Manner is about how, in what manner. And ASL marks, English marks both of those by just using separate words. You know, we stick in another word or two in the verb phrase. And ASL does stuff a little bit differently. In ASL, a lot of adverbial function is contained on the mouth. So we have an example of three sort of mouthing adverbs. And these are adverbs of manner. They express the way in which something was done. So we have one to express carelessly, effortlessly, or carefully. Okay? So if I wanted to say that my dad is a lousy driver, he just drives without care, I could say, if I wanted to just say my dad is driving, no other information. Father, drive. But if I wanted to say that he was driving carelessly, if I wanted to show me what it would look like if I wanted to say my father was driving effortlessly. The middle one. How about carefully? Okay? And then these are productive, which means when something is productive in a language, that means it's a bit of structure that can attach to lots of different other structures. So these adverbs can go with pretty much any verb that can accept manner. So I can say, my grandmother, or I can say, my grandmother, or, you know, my 104-year-old grandmother is doing fine, she doesn't need any help walking. Right? Likewise, studying, you can study carelessly or carefully, whatever. You get the point of this? Yeah. Yeah, that's a great question. So Jan just asked, how does this work when signers try to move their lips to represent spoken words? This is one of the reasons that trying to talk and sign at the same time doesn't really work. Because you can't do a mouthing adverb at the same time as you're pronouncing a spoken word. And so something like, do you want to? So Jonathan's response is totally right, and applying primarily to deaf people who are like using strong ASL, where the language itself has organized so that mouthings are fine and in fact common on nouns and less so on verbs. And my first response was more about hearing people who sign and who kind of sign more Englishy. When they sign more Englishy, that's primarily because they're using English and they're mouthing English, and it doesn't when you're mouthing English and using that as your base language, it doesn't have a space to allow you to do this kind of inflection. Yeah. Cool. Good question, Jen. All right, so now we've seen a couple things that are going on in the upper face zone. Adverbials are now going on below the face, right, in the mouth. Questions on how that works? All right, so now we get to combine these things. Right? So in all these cases, we have a basic declarative sentence here on the left. And so I want a volunteer. You know, here's the sign for father. Here's the sign drive. So I want someone to volunteer before I tell them what to do. Ha, 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 ha. Who's feeling brave? Yes, my friends. All right. So this is father drive. Give me, is father driving? The polar question. Good. Good. Looks like that. Somebody else who's not a signer is also, okay. Give me... the baby is walking carelessly. So here's baby walking carelessly. Good. Baby. Yeah. Now somebody who's brave, going to combine things. Anybody want a challenge? Preferably. Does that knock you out? Are you an ASL 1? Okay. Do you want to try? All right. Is the student studying carefully? This is bottom right. Oh, sorry. Student? Mm-hmm. Study. Good. Yeah. Student? Good. Yeah. Good. Close. I know you guys can't see. So this is student... So eyebrows have to go up at the beginning. You're producing student, and then study carefully. Is the student studying carefully? That's great. Good job. These are things that you can get more practice with in the tutorial session. You can sort of make sentences into questions. You can flip, you know, which adverb goes with which, and you should get comfortable. Understanding how these different parts combine to express these different meanings. Okay. Questions more on this? All right. We are making pretty good time, so I'm fine slowing down. Or not. All right, or not. Ha, ha, ha. All right, so this is a sentence that isn't negated is called an affirmative sentence. And so a sentence like, the student will study, that's an affirmative sentence. How do you make that negative? The student won't study. How else can you do it? The student will not study. Right. So these are things, they are both kind of the same process in English. It's just that won't has become contracted is probably the word that you're familiar with. Cliticized. I don't know why linguists have to have different words that mean the same thing. In linguistics, this is called a clitic. You don't need to worry about it. It'll be easier for us to think about the student will not study, but the same process more or less happens in clitics. So the rule here is you add a not, but where does the not go? You know, but will is an auxiliary verb. Study is a main verb. Can I say the student not will study? Can I say the student will study not? Maybe if I'm like writing a sonnet or something. we'll get there too. The student will not study. So we want, in English, we want the negator to go between the auxiliary verb and the main verb. Or if there is no auxiliary verb, so actually, let me ask you, what happens when there's no auxiliary verb here? Let's say the original affirmative sentence is, the student studies. Does not study, right? Where does the do come from? Yeah, it's the same process that's going on. It comes from the same place that it does in the polar question. Whatever that place in your head is, It's coming from there. And it's doing the same job, right? It is taking on the inflection that the original verb in the affirmative sentence had, and it's leaving that verb in its plain form. You know, the student does not study. All right. Does that make sense for English? Cool. Dive on to ASL. So once again, we have the sentence, student will study. Student will study. And to make that negative, there's a couple things we can do. We can say, student will not study, where we insert this sign that has the meaning not. It works just like it does in English. So this is what we call this a lexical negator. It means lexical, right, is just a word. So in this case, a sign, a free morpheme. And it also goes in between an auxiliary verb and a main verb. So student will not study. That's cool. We can do the same thing also in English with like won't, where we have just a different sign that expresses negation. So the student won't study. These two signs, not and won't, are probably a little less related than will and will not, or sorry, than will not and won't. But whatever, don't worry about that. Just understand that, so ASL can do lexical negation this way, it can do lexical negation this way, won't. But also, the face is often involved in negation, face and head. So you can say, the signs that you produce could be identical to the student studies, an affirmative sentence. And so if you're only paying attention to the hands, you would think that the sentence would mean the student studies. But if you are Ling 7 students and you're learning that the face matters for grammar, you will pay attention to what's going on in my head. And you see it looks like something like this. Student doesn't study. Or if you wanted to be extra fancy, but really it's not extra fancy, it's just part of the language, you can do both. You can add the lexical not and the negative headshake. So I can say, so in English, a sentence like, the student doesn't not study, having two negative markers in that sentence flips the meaning a little bit, right? It's like I don't not want pizza. That means that I kind of want pizza. But in ASL, having both negative markers doesn't change the meaning of the sentence. It's still just the student doesn't study. Also notice, what is the scope of the facial expression in the ASL negatives? Were we, somebody back here? Yes. Well, actually, no, because the notation is there, and you need to learn how to read the notation. So where does the facial expression start? After the noun, right? So here it starts on the verb, and here it starts on this lexical not, which really is part of the verb phrase. So we're going to say that in negation for ASL, if there's a facial expression involved, it starts at the onset of the verb phrase. If I had won't up here, it would also be, so student won't study. The head shake is going to start with the onset of the verb phrase. This is different from question formation, where we saw that the facial expression attached to the entire sentence. Right? Here, the facial expression attaches to a particular part of the sentence, which is the verb phrase. All right? So if we're going to break down the ASL rules here, there's three options. One is to add a lexical not or won't, some sort of lexical negator, before the main verb, and that's just like English. Two is that you can add a negative headshake over the verb phrase. And three is you can combine both one and two, and that doesn't change the meaning at all. It still means simple negation. One more thing, just quickly about number two. Have you guys heard at all about research efforts that are investing really heavily in coming up with these sign language gloves and the software that's going to interpret sign based on, you know, you wear these gloves, or some are doing it even without gloves, but these cameras, like a Kinect or something, are watching the movement of your hands, and they're trying to use that to perform automated sign language interpretation. It's really cool, but it's kind of a bad idea if you don't include the face, right? Because all of a sudden you get student study, the gloves think the same thing. They're missing a ton of grammatical information because they often don't understand really how sign language works. They're starting to get better, and of course any engineering project like this has to start somewhere, and so it's fine. But eventually they're going to need some way to incorporate facial information into this automated sign language recognition stuff, or else it's never going to get off the ground. Because try ordering pizza and saying, I don't want anchovies, and it looks like you're saying, I want anchovies. Yeah. Some of them are using these point light displays. Actually, Jonathan probably knows a lot more about this than I do. So if you have questions about that, go ahead and talk to him. All right, any other questions on negation? Okay, so negation goes kind of up here. It's in this whole head circle thing, right? I can't just move the upper or lower half of my face. That would be weird. So, yeah, that'd be very strange. All right, the next linguistic process I want to talk about is called topicalization. So next topic. Man, I'm good today. So here is what we call a canonical sentence. This is just a regular, ordinary sentence. Nim likes oranges. Do you remember who Nim was?
Oh, yeah.
Somebody tell me? Yes. Nim was one of the chimps who was taught, or who was attempting to learn ASL, ended up just acquiring a bunch of signs and would put them together in kind of random orders to get oranges. So, Nim likes oranges. The sentences like this make us want to talk about two different kinds of linguistic structure. One is about syntactic structure, so grammatical, things like subjects, verbs, and objects. But there's another level of structure that's also above the word level. It's in this sort of syntax land, but it's called semantic structure, where we talk not about the grammatical role that something plays in a sentence, but about its meaning role. And these are things like agents, you know, things who do things, patients, what things are done to. There are also things like topic, like what an utterance is about. These things are correlated, but they can be dissociated. So here, the topic of the sentence is oranges. But grammatically speaking, oranges is the object of the verb. Let me pause and make this a little bit more clear. So we have a sentence, a canonical active sentence like the cat chased the dog. Okay? In my world, cats chase dogs. In this sentence, we have a couple levels of structure already going on in the sentence. The cat is the subject, chased is the verb, and the dog is the object. Good. Cat is also doing the chasing, so we call that the agent. Chased is the action. And dog is the patient, or another role might be the experiencer or something like that. These terms are often correlated, so it usually is the case that an agent is going to be a subject, and an action is going to be a verb, and a patient is going to be an object, but not always. So I can have a sentence like, the dog was chased by the cat, or I can have a sentence like, well, let's work through this one and I'll think of another one. So in this sentence, in terms of these three things, what is the dog? That's in terms of these three things, and that's right. The dog here is the subject, and how do you know? Because it comes first in English, that's a good cue. Also, what would happen if I did this? We have to switch was to were, right? And that's because subject-verb agreement is really strong in English. Good, so we have dogs as the grammatical subject, but the semantic patient. We got a switch there. Verb is still, chase is still a verb, and then cat is now the object of this prepositional phrase, but it's still the semantic agent. Right? That was a big but important digression from talking about topicalization. The point of this is to realize that this can be, often we think that the subject of a sentence is what the sentence is about, but that's not always true. The topic of a sentence can sometimes be in the object position. And so that's what I'm illustrating back here, where we have Nim likes oranges. The topic of the sentence is really oranges. If we were in some other discourse situation where we're talking about lots of different animals and we wanted to say something specific about Nim, we could make Nim the topic. But here, just as a default basic sentence in English, oranges is the topic. And if we wanted to make this topicalized, where we want to put more emphasis on the topic, we might want to do something like oranges Nim likes. But in English, that process doesn't, it sounds kind of funny, right? And that's why I have this question mark in front of it. We can see a little bit, slightly more acceptable version of the sentence if we do something like, Nim doesn't care for apples, but oranges he likes. Does that make sense? Is that a little better? A little better. It's still a little bit awkward. Some dialects of English permit this a lot more freely than others, particularly in dialects that have descended from Yiddish or other languages that have much more topic. But yeah, in English, this is questionable at best. It's not very common. If there were to be a rule, it would be move the object, in this case oranges, to the beginning of the phrase. And what that does is it puts more emphasis on that topic of the sentence. In ASL, this process actually happens a lot, and it's much more grammatically acceptable. It's very regular. But it does change word order, right? Now we have sentences with a different word order than is typical. The way that ASL accommodates this is by marking the fact that topicalization has happened in the eyebrows. Okay? So here's what a topicalized sentence would look like. Oh, by the way, this is how Yoda talks, right? To study the student needs. So the sentence would look something like this. The basic one, right? Student needs study. Topicalized, study, student need. Study, student need. Notice what happens to my eyebrows. What do? They go up. And when do they go up? On the verb. Well, okay, good. Thank you. Good. This is a great example. I was trying to think before about when a verb can be not a verb. This is a sentence. So in the regular sentence, the student needs to study. What's the subject? What's the verb?
Needs.
And then the object of the sentence is study. That is what the student needs. Right? So semantically speaking, studying is an action. But grammatically speaking, in this kind of context, to study is the object of a verb. Okay? And so if we want to topicalize that, we're going to take the object, which is to study, going to move it to the front of the sentence, and then to show that this is a topicalized object, rather than just being an ordinary noun phrase that's starting a regular canonical sentence, we mark that topicalization by raising eyebrows, but the eyebrows only stay raised for the duration of that phrase that has been topicalized. As soon as you're done with that moved phrase, eyebrows drop back down. So I'll show you this again. Regular sentence and then the topicalized version. Regular sentence, student needs study. Topicalized, study, student need. Could you see it? Okay. So we have a couple more examples of this. So, I like your new car. B, I like your new car. And it's, again, subject is verb, object, your new car. Right? That's important. It's that whole phrase, your new car. It's not just the car. So if I want to topicalize this, I say, your new car, I like. So eyebrows go up, your new car, finished, they go down, I like. Same with the boy bit the dog. I don't know. I didn't make that up. Did I? Maybe I did. I stole these slides from Dr. Mayberry. So the boy bit the dog. The dog, the boy bit. Right. Where you have this marking. And so this is, aha, now I know why she used this example. This is a way for us to show, this kind of structure in languages allows us to say things grammatically that don't make sense if you just thought about semantics alone. Kind of my sentence there too is an attempt at this. This one's better. If I just gave you these words, you know, bit, the dog, the boy, and you had to put them together somehow, you'd probably, as a reasonable person, you'd probably think, all right, well, the boy probably bit the dog probably bit the boy, right? That's how the world works that we're used to. What's cool about language is that it allows us to say things that violate our knowledge about how the world normally works. These things are sometimes called counterfactuals. You don't need to know that word. The fact that we have this linguistic structure can tell us, even though I got the sentence with a biting event and a dog and a boy, and even though the dog came first, like it ordinarily would in a if it were the dog bit the boy, the fact that I have raised my eyebrows over the dog and then I lower them to say the boy bit, that tells me, oh, nope, that's not a subject. That dog there is the object of the sentence, and it's just been topicalized. Right, so understanding the facial structure is really critical for getting the intended purpose, the intended meaning of an utterance. Yes?
When an ASL signer is writing, do they sometimes write sentences structured like this because that's how they use it in their language?
It'll depend on that person's fluency with English, but yes, absolutely. If they're not super proficient in written English, like you and I probably would write if we were, you know, trying to write in our high school Spanish or French or whatever, and English structure intrudes into the writing, same thing is going to happen in ASL, for sure. Other questions? All right. Subject copy is our next structure. Subject copy is one that, you know, if you thought topicalization was weird in English, subject copy is even worse. English doesn't really do it. So here, sentences without subject copy. Nim likes oranges. Hipsters like Instagram. If we were to use subject copy, these sentences would sound something like this. So, Nim likes oranges, he does. Or hipsters like Instagram, they do. They're really stilted and awkward. Do these sentences sound good to anybody? Do these sentences sound like worse than questionable? Do they just sound outright wrong and ungrammatical?
They sound okay.
So I have them notated well. Good, thanks. If we were to describe the process that's going on here, we would say that what you do is you repeat a pronominal form of the subject at the end of the sentence, and then you add do support, properly inflected. So notice that at the end of the sentence, Nim likes oranges, what pronoun do I have to pick? Describe its features for me. What's its person? Third, its number? Case? Ooh. Subjective. Yes, I do expect you to still know the stuff that was on the midterm. The final will be cumulative as well. So don't forget all that stuff. I'm teaching this class so you remember things. So yes, third person singular, subjective, because Nim is the subject, and this is called a subject copy. It's going to keep that case. And then gender?
Male.
He. Yes. Okay, so then the point here is that the pronoun that you repeat copies whatever the subject was. It repeats the, it has the same features as whatever the subject did. So here when we have hipsters like Instagram, this is what person? Third, again. Number? Plural, because hipsters is plural. Case? Subjective, right? I can't say hipsters like Instagram, them do. Doesn't work. And then in English third person plural, there's no gender marking. Cool. Does that make sense? Even though it's not something that English does very much, I want you to understand how it would work if it would happen, because that's how it works in ASL. So in ASL, this is also a process that happens much more commonly. This is what Alex brought up earlier, and I said we'd get to it, so we are. Here we have a sentence like, student needs to study, and then I produce a pronominal copy of the subject at the end of the student, at the end of the sentence. I can't say the student needs to study the student. You know, if I reproduce the full noun phrase form of the phrase, then it sounds like, you know, this student needs to study that student, and that's not the meaning. Instead, I produce a pronominal copy, say student needs to study, and then this I add this little head nod to go with it. So there's a pronominal copy and then a head nod. Hopefully that is marked. Yes. So I have student needs study, pro form. Here this number and subscript here reflects the person. The case isn't notated here, but you know that the case is going to have to be plain case, because any subjects in ASL are also always going to be in plain case. And this line here indicates that there's some head stuff going on. In this case, HN stands for head nod, this little affirmative thing here. And that's actually, that little nod is how we tell the difference between the student needs to study, he does, versus the student needs to study him, or the student needs to study that. That's, if we wanted to produce a pronoun in this position, and we wanted it to be the object of a sentence, we would leave off the head nod. Yeah? Third person. Shows third person. All right, I think we might have, yeah, okay, so, and again, the particular form of the pronoun that you choose here has to match whatever the subject was. So, if I wanted to say, you need to study, what pronoun would I copy? You, plural, right? I couldn't just say, you need to study. That's not good. It's got to match. You need to study. Again, I haven't looked at the midterms yet, so I don't know. Might not be true. Likewise, I could say, I need to study, or, yeah, and you would have that first person pronoun match with the head nod. How are we doing? Hanging in? Okay. We've got 5 minutes. Let me just recap a little bit on facial grammar and then show you a video. So we have now learned that there's an awful lot of linguistic structure that's being marked on the face and on the head. It's not just all in your hands. So far in class, we've really been focused on what your hand is doing, the orientation, hand shape, movement, location. But we really now are learning that if we're going to understand syntactic structure, we need to not look just at the hands, but also at the face. There's questions going on in the upper face zone, raising for yes-no questions, furrowing for WH questions with these particular onsets and offsets. Negation has these head shakes. Topicalization has eyebrow raising. Subject copy has head nodding. And add on top of that all of these emotional functions of the face. So this is telling us that facial expression and understanding facial expressions is really a critical part of ASL. And this lady has an interesting story about that.
Different cultures, not the white American culture.
so. I would be friends with international students, with people of different cultures. And it happened, she and I were having a very serious discussion, and I gave her my full attention. Well, then she yelled at me and said, "You are staring at me." I said, "Staring? I'm not staring." She says, "Yes, you are. You're drilling holes through my skull." I said, "No, no, I'm paying attention." So I know that hearing people don't like to have constant eye contact. So I tried to move my eyes around, but I didn't do it right. And then she thought I wasn't paying attention at all. She says, "It's like talking to Mr. Magoo." She knew my parents were deaf, but she didn't really get it. So I said, "Wait a minute. My mom and dad are deaf." And she says, "So what?" I said, "No, no, no. That means eye contact is crucial. If I'm not looking right at you, that means I'm not paying attention." And that's all it took. We had argued over it, but that's all it took. And I said, "I'm sorry. I don't know how to give you the eye contact that you want. I know that when you need to talk with me, I need to look at you, and that's what I know how to do." Once I shared my reason, she had no problem with it, and we got along much better after that. Hearing people get nervous if you look at them too much.
What you just said reminds me of a Coda woman who told me about her experience with her husband.
Coda is when your parents are deaf, but you're hearing.
For several years, and she would often become upset with him when they were talking about a serious matter. She felt that her husband was not paying attention to her because she'd be talking and, well, after a while she couldn't stand it and said, "You're not paying attention to me." He said, "Well, honestly, I pay attention to everything you say." And she said, "No, you're not paying attention to what I'm saying." They couldn't figure out what was going on. She didn't think about it. She needed to figure out what was happening. Well, it came out in conversation that when her husband dealt with something serious, he looked toward the floor. He did not make direct eye contact. That did not work for the wife. She felt there was no communication. She realized that it was her family, the way she grew up, where eye contact was crucial, and that he violated some sort of rule. What you said about straight talk is important. It's very difficult for some people to deal with.
So because so much grammatical information is on the face there, you got to maintain eye contact and be able to get all that in. This is just a commercial for why you need to go to tutorial, because I probably won't talk a lot about this in lecture next time, but you should be able to for the web quizzes, for the exam, I'm going to expect you to be able to combine things like this, mouthing adverbs with yes-no questions like we did in class, but also things like, how does topic comment structure look with an inflecting verb? Right? How does subject copy combine with topic comment? And what kind of utterances do those produce? So that's the kind of stuff you'll learn in tutorial, so strongly recommend that you go. Have a good weekend. We'll see you next time. Oh, great.
At least from year.
Okay.
So
from, do you know what year?
It's either 2010 or 2011 if you came in before then.
Okay.
Because that's before they implemented the
campus-wide. Great. Thank you. Yes.
Hi, my name is Sonia.
Oh, yes. Hi. I'm not sure that there's much I can do at this point.
So, I guess I would like to know the extra credit lesson.
I mean, the options that are available to you. I'm sorry.
This has been a UC San Diego podcast. For more, visit podcast.ucsd.edu.